Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 22nd of September. This hour, we're going to be talking about the absolutely fascinating history of Wisconsin Public Radio. Randall Davidson is our guest, and Randall is known as the historian and very thorough historian of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Ideas Network, as you probably know, this year. This book goes way back to the early teens in the century previous to this century. Randall's author of 9XM Talking, WHA Radio, and the Wisconsin Idea. He is the director of radio services at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. He spent many years before going to Oshkosh, 18 years with Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, where he was a news producer, the network's afternoon newscaster, network's chief announcer, training new announcers and filling in on music programs when needed, most often on Simply Folk. But he certainly knows all of the ins and outs and the intricacies and the history of this phenomenal facility. He began his career at WRST in Oshkosh and later worked as a disc jockey and sportscaster at commercial station WHBY AM in Appleton. He reported for UPI in Madison when he was in graduate school. He's been a teaching assistant in radio production at UW-Madison and taught a course in radio programming theory at UW-Oshkosh. He's a native of Neenah, Wisconsin. Many of you, I'm sure, remember certain programs. Some are probably beyond the memory of many of us, and it's wonderful Randall has brought them to this book. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. Randall also brought some sound, so we'll be able to hear some of those early shows. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Randall. Thanks so much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
You know, I read this book, and I'm so proud to be a member of this great institution. There is so much history. We were just pioneers in the whole beginning of radio in this country.
It's true. WHA, the flagship station in Madison, the AM station that's still on the air in Madison, invented a lot of what is now known as non-commercial radio, what became public radio. It started right at the beginning, the concept of doing radio as a service to benefit people and to bring the value of the university to all listeners. That was that idea of using the university for the benefit of everybody was kind of percolating around the University of Wisconsin about the time the radio station got going. And they kind of worked together to kind of be an embodiment of the Wisconsin idea. The radio station was bringing the riches of the university to benefit everyone. That was kind of a radical notion at the beginning of the 20th century. Prior to that, a university was just primarily for its students. And here in Wisconsin, the idea was, well, no, it's really to benefit everyone, and the radio station was part of that.
Tell us some of the early in the book, you talk about some unsung heroes, some people who really were so instrumental. It's good to remember people who died a long time ago, but were so instrumental in starting this.
Well, the big hero for me is Earl Terry. He was a physics professor. He had come to Madison to get his master's degree. He's from Michigan, and came to the University of Wisconsin-Madison to get his master's degree in physics and got hooked into this notion of wireless telegraphy, sending the dots and dashes of Morse code not through wires but through the air. And this was the beginnings of radio. You could send a message from point to point through the air, a Morse code message. And some people thought, well, this will only be useful to places where you can't get a wire, like to a ship at sea or to a mountaintop or something like that. But hobbyists were tuning in to these messages and eavesdropping. And some people realized that you could use this phenomenon, this eavesdropping phenomenon, to send one message to many people at once. And that's kind of the essence of broadcasting. So Terry and some other experimenters were working on this. They got a wireless telegraphic transmitter going on campus. And they wanted to use it for something, though. This Wisconsin idea was always present. And they said, what can we use it for that would benefit people? What can we send? And they got permission to send the weather forecast in Morse code. And they would do this at 11 o'clock in the morning on weekdays and Saturday. And they put it at 11 because that was right after the most popular radio show of the era. At 10:55, you could tune to the Navy's station in Virginia and get the time in Morse code. So people would tune to get the time. Then they dial the radio down to where 9XM was, which is where it was on the dial then. You'd get the weather forecast for Wisconsin, and that was the bulk of your programming that you could get at that time. So it was to benefit people. But Earl Terry, after they got the radio station going, his bosses at the physics department were kind of cool to him spending so much time with this. They rather him that he'd stay with his research and everything like that. And he really had kind of spent a lot of time keeping this radio station afloat. And I think maybe a little bit to the detriment of his career. I get the sense that his family wasn't much pleased by all this either. He turned down some really lucrative positions to stay at the University of Wisconsin and keep the station afloat. The sad part is that we, in the early years, we shared the frequency with other stations. You could have, you know, we'd want these 2 hours on Monday and Wednesday, then a station in Indiana would have the frequency for these 2 hours, and a station in Chicago would have it for these 2 hours. And you were sharing the frequency with other stations. He finally got the rights to a good frequency exclusively in the Madison area, AM 940 back then. The day he signed the paperwork for that, he went home that night and he died as a rather young man. He was only 50 at the time.
Goodness.
And then that fall, the station really took off. It had a frequency to itself, and he never really got to see the fruits of all this effort that he put forth keeping the station alive. And he's kind of the real hero of the story, and I'm happy to say that largely on the basis of this book, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association this past summer decided to induct him into the Broadcasters Hall of Fame for the state,
Randall,
kind of
nice.
Posthumously. And myself and Larry Mueller were in the video presentation about Earl
Very
Terry
nice.
And the work that he's done. So kind of late, but better late than never. Yeah, he's now given the due that I think he's
That's
deserved
great.
All these years.
Well, there's something about, and you have this bug, and I have the bug too, but there are other people in the book who are mentioned. There's something about the radio business, and mm-hmm. it happened early on, that you may forsake some of your studies. You may be more interested in doing your broadcast because it's all-consuming, and you realize that it could be influential, that you have all these great ideas, and you're communicating them. You get hooked on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a student, the first student involved at 9XM was a guy named Malcolm Hansen, and he was really, it was interesting, he was an employee of the physics department to work at the radio station while he was a student in the electrical engineering department. So he's already employed by the physics department as a radio person. As his grades are just disappearing below the surface in the electrical engineering department, he was actually told by the university, you have to leave.
Oh,
you're not going to get your degree. It's time for you to leave. But it was his work that made the vision that Earl Terry had come to life. And it was, and I warned my students. I mean, yes, it's interesting to be involved in radio. Don't let it sink you. I don't want any students to flunk out because they're so dedicated to radio. It is addictive, as you know, as I know. You can. There's always stuff to do. There's always
exactly.
more work to do.
Right.
And it can take up a lot. It can
take up
your life. So here, Malcolm Hansen, poor guy, he got kind of shuffled out of the university, and interestingly, went back into the Navy, became the radio operator for Admiral Byrd's expeditions. And then during World War II, was on a military plane and died. His plane crashed into a mountainside in Alaska in 1942. But he was an early pioneer as well. And he and Earl Terry were kind of a team, and back in those early days, and kind of kept the place alive with, you know, borrowed equipment and homemade gear, and they're blowing the transmitter tubes themselves. And it was very, very rudimentary, but
right.
groundbreaking nonetheless.
Let's go to a point and tell me what year this would be when you've got this, all of a sudden you've got this technology and people can hear what you're mm-hmm. broadcasting. It's not just eavesdropping on whatever.
No.
You decide that you need some ideas that are going to be transmitted. Who was in on the discussions of how this should be used?
Well, a radio committee formed at the university rather early on. One of the early leading lights was a guy named William Lighty. He was in charge of what became the Extension Division, which is one of our partner agencies that runs Wisconsin Public Radio now. It's part of UW Extension. And he was on campus with his sons and saw these sparks coming from the basement of Sterling Hall and went in to see what was going on. There's a radio station there. He said, well, here's something he could use. This is his – part of his mission is to get things out to the public, to be the, you know, the embodiment of the extension ideal. And he realized he could partner with the radio station and do good work that way. And he kind of became the program director. And he started barging into faculty meetings and trying to get other professors to come on the radio. And he had a fair amount of success. He was kind of a eccentric fellow, too, one of the last people to commute to Madison on horseback. he was a little bit of an eccentric, had the Windsor tie and kind of a goatee. But he was kind of the program director. He left Terry kind of run the mechanical day-to-day, and then you have Malcolm Hansen, who's kind of the operator-announcer of the operation. But there was like the Agriculture College was very heavily involved early on. And they were starting to provide programming that they would just come in and provide, you know, agricultural topics. And they got involved early on. Again, that sense of serving the public. How can we get this information out to people that can benefit from it? And so ideas, you know, they're making this up as they go along. There was no real radio industry in this early right. day. Although there was this sense, and Earl Terry was a big proponent of this, that it was important that we remain non-commercial and not entangled with commercial enterprises. Mm-hmm. The Milwaukee Journal approached the
station. Interesting story. Yeah,
they approached the station early on before they had their own radio station. And they said, we're very impressed with what you're doing. We'd like to partner with you. Look at what we'll provide you. We'll buy you a new transmitter. We'll pay for staff for you so you can be on more hours a day. And at the end of 3 years or whatever, you get to keep the gear. So there's a big opportunity there. And Earl Terry was immediately suspicious. He thought, well, they're going to want exclusive rights to this signal then. They're going to want just Milwaukee Journal material on this signal. And he wrote them. He went, kicked this up to the Board of Regents and kind of made his case that we really can't go this way, even though we don't have any money. And this is very attractive. We can't do this. And the Regents supported him in this. And he wrote a very nice letter back to the Journal and said, well, we'd love to partner with you, but we'd like to have the right to bring in stuff like, say, from the Chicago Tribune and other sure. papers. If you're fine with that, then maybe we can talk. But we assume you want to be exclusive. And the Journal said, well, thank you, but, you know, we appreciate it. Maybe we can work together, you know. And then when the Journal got their own station, things weren't nearly so nice. There were some times when the Milwaukee Journal station tried to force WHA off the air.
And, really?
Oh, yes. There was a lot of pressure from commercial broadcasters to get – well, as you know, one of the things of radio is that you can only listen to one station at a time. Anytime there's another station in your market, by definition, those listeners can't be listening – to the other station.
Right,
so
right.
It was a competition. There was some collaboration, though, in the late 20s. WTMJ in Milwaukee carried Wisconsin, the WHA Farm Show, 3 days a week. So there was some cooperation there with commercial broadcasters. But they were making this up as they went along in Madison, but they kept that notion of saying, we got to steer clear of commercial.
Or commercial it maybe wouldn't have existed at all.
The thing with AM radio, there's no frequencies that are reserved for non-commercial use. In the FM band, everything below 92 has to remain non-commercial. It can't be sold to a commercial enterprise. The AM band is not like that, and that's why there are so few AM public radio stations, because during the Depression, colleges in need of money would just sell their frequency to a commercial operator, and it'd be gone. And it's not going to come back. It's rare that one goes from being commercial to non-commercial. It hardly ever happens. Hmm.
Let's talk about World War One for a moment, because I was not aware that operations had to be suspended. Mm-hmm. Wilson, I guess, gave an edict. But WHA was able to continue with its work in early radio. Why was that?
Well, the nature of AM radio is that the signals bounce at night off the atmosphere. And you can hear – that's a popular hobby thing for AM radio enthusiasts, to listen to distant radio stations. I can pick up Winnipeg at night on my car radio on AM 990 from Winnipeg.
Really?
And it comes in late at night, which is kind of nice. But this technology is brand new. They're not quite sure how they can use it. The Germans are already using it to send messages that they hope will be eavesdropped upon with propaganda in them. And so Wilson, President Wilson, gives out an edict that says we have to shut down all radio operations in the United States. And if you own a radio receiver, you're going to have to dismantle it. You can't listen to the radio. If you're a hobbyist, you have to dismantle it for the duration. But 9XM in Madison was doing experiments with the Navy, and they asked for special permission to stay on the air to do these experiments. Now, it's not really radio broadcasting. There's no listeners.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the claims that WHA has. Well, we were on during the war when everyone else was off. Well, not quite everyone else. You know, KDK in Pittsburgh's, they always have a claim on being first. They were on with experimental stuff during the war, too. And several others were on. But WHA has this claim that they were on during the war. And as they experimented, the nice thing about being on during that time is experimentation could continue. And they started moving away from Morse code and more toward speech. And they were able to do human speech, you know, phonograph records, things like that, that made it widely available after the war.
So is WHA, I know you include this, the last part of the book, the oldest station in the country?
It depends what you call, you know, you have to define your terms. It's not the first, certainly. There were stations that were on before it, but they had big gaps in their service. KDKA in Pittsburgh came on with the 1920 election results, and they have a pretty good claim. WHA looks like it came on 5 days later.
5 days
yeah,
later.
Yeah, that following Saturday we came on, it looks like. And Malcolm Hansen, this first announcer, he told the guy that replaced him, the student that replaced him, he said, you know, we missed being the first by 5 days. And that's the little, you know, piece of the puzzle. But we were doing Morse code in 1916. There was experiments with sound in early 1917. But if you want a regular schedule of voice broadcasting for the public by radio waves, it looks like it's the first week of November 1920 for WHA. And the real regular schedule got going in January of 21, where there was a printed schedule that you could count on a regular basis. And it's the weather forecast in spoken word and Morse code.
Huh. But we did have the second weatherman in the United States.
The second radio weatherman in the United States was at WHA. The guy at the Weather Bureau in Madison would be on the air. They ran a microphone up to his office, and he would go on at different times. And the rule was the university switchboard was not supposed to route calls to his office while he was on the air, and they'd forget. And the phone would ring in the background while he's doing the weather. And he'd just stop. Oh, I have to answer the phone. He'd go pick up. He'd just pick up the phone and answer it. And I'm on the air right now and hang it up. So,
I'd love to hear a recording of that.
So he was kind of another character that people really liked. He had kind of an interesting following among listeners.
The pictures in this book, everybody got really dressed to be at the radio, didn't they? Oh my gosh,
everyone's,
the ties, the outfits. Woo!
Wearing a necktie and looking nice. And yep. And Fanny Steve, who did Rhythm and Games, she'd have a nice stylish hat.
Hat. Of course. Let's take phone calls. We'll also hear some sound, too. Randall will set it up for us. Randall, who will be getting leaving the studio and riding his horse back to Oshkosh this afternoon. You should have one, Randall. That would be great.
Where would I put the parking sticker? So.
The least of your worries. Let's take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Randall is the author of 9XM Talking, WHA Radio and the Wisconsin Idea. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are going to take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. A couple lines are open right now. We start our calls with Dick from Sister Bay. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm interested in maybe a little conversation about Carl Schmidt. He was a professor of mine in, I'll say, 1962, and he is still on the air.
Yep.
Pretty well holding down the fort, not entirely, at a chapter a day. Does Randall have any information about, let's see, how long he's been on the air, and is it time to start looking at the Guinness Book of World Records?
He's been on a long time. He started with the station in 1940 when he was a student. And
1940.
Yeah, and then he was station program director, and he took a sabbatical from that to run Earplay, and which was our radio drama series in the 70s and 80s. But he's still doing Chapter a Day. I've always maintained he's probably the best at reading just for a long period of time without stumbling. It's really amazing. But he did many, many other programs besides Chapter a Day. We have a piece of audio here from 1948, if we want to play that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's Book Trails.
Book
Trails, a Wisconsin School of the Air program for schools. And that was Carl on that in the late 40s.
What a beautiful reading of that. I want to listen to the whole thing.
Carl was host of many different programs. Chapter a Day was the one he's most associated with, I suppose. But, he's been on for a lot of years. And
yeah.
I just go back through my memory of all the books I've heard him read all through the years. And for many years, my job at WPR was running Chapter a Day. It seemed to fall when the times I was on the air where I'd have to run the tape and later the CD of the program. So I got to hear lots of Chapter a Day, and it was fun to listen to him, and he keeps all the voices straight in his head, the inflections and all that. It's just great.
Yeah, it's quite a skill. And is this story true that somebody didn't show up, one of the guests, and so somebody picked up a book and started reading, or is that not true?
Yeah, that's the legend, that Chapter a Day got going that way. I had to debunk a little bit of that, though. The story is that in the late 20s, 27 or so, a guest didn't show. And so if you didn't have a guest, you would have grabbed the book that you had.
I would have grabbed your book, 9XM Talking.
Thank you very much. But someone just read a book for a half hour, and the legend is that someone said, well, what happens next in that book? But it wasn't like the next day they started the show. It's a while later. The earliest reference I've got to Chapter a Day was a summer fill-in show in 1932, and it originally was designed to just be new releases in books. Because we had another show that was done in cooperation with the School for the Blind in Janesville that was classic literature. But the Chapter a Day was supposed to be just brand new literature. And it was done by students. It was read live. And they hadn't quite got the bugs out of it. So now we take the book and we chop it down into 25-minute segments. Then they were just taking the book and they'd look at the clock, well, got to stop reading kind of. And it would take 7 days or 9 days to read the book. Now we try to do them in groups of multiples of five. But it started in 32. It's been on year-round since 1939, since early 1939.
It's a long time.
So, and it's not the longest-running radio show in the world. There's been a couple others that have been on longer. There was another one in non-commercial radio. WOI and Ames had a show that had been on since 1923.
Woo!
And, of course, the Grand Ole Opry's been on for longer than that, but it was up there. It's longer than Letter from America with Alistair Cook, which is on BBC, and it was on longer than, quite a few others. There's some other ones that aren't year-round that predate it, the Metropolitan Opera being primary among those. So, it's been on. Chapter's been on a long time. Carl's been with it for a long time, and it's fun to listen to.
And is it because of what you said earlier that it's on so long because people always say, what's going to happen next?
I think so. I whenever we've had a murder mystery and people missed the last chapter, my phone would ring off the wall back
really?
In the newsroom. People say, who was the murderer?
So you really were listening every moment. All right, let's go to Nancy in Madison. Our number is 800-486-8655. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. We moved to Madison in 1964, and while we were working on our house, we spent quite a bit of time listening to what was very new to us, public radio, and listening to lectures coming directly from the university. And my question was, when did that change? Was there some sort of policy that will no longer broadcast these lectures, either live or on tape?
They went on for quite a while. Amazingly, they weren't offered for credit until they'd been on for 35 years. But they still get calls about Michael Petrovich with the History of Russia lectures, and actually the UW Extension has been working to offer those or to digitize those and preserve them. When I started at WPR in 90, we were still doing them. Their afternoon schedule had to be relinquished for Talk of the Nation. When they started carrying Talk of the Nation, that's kind of where we used to have University of the Air.
Oh.
And then they remanufactured it and reconstitute it. Now it's the show that Norman Gilliland hosts on Sundays, which still has the University of the Air name, but the classroom lecture is not part of it anymore. But that was a big part of it for a long time. Started in 1933.
Can you talk about, because I know you don't spend a lot of time on the book, and it's hard for many of us, namely me, to understand this, but what technological advancements took place that allowed shows like Talk of the Nation, that what did computers do for Wisconsin Public Radio? Or
one of the big things that was a big technological leap forward was the development of having a network. We'd been part of United Press International's radio network in the late 60s, but there'd never been a radio network from the non-commercial stations. They were sharing tapes, sending a tape from one station to another. But NPR got going in 1971, and that was originally just a big broadcast loop of ground lines, telephone lines. And it would come up through Madison, and we, of course, would broadcast by sending the signal from station to station. That was a big leap. And then in 1979, they moved to satellite distribution, much better quality. You can have many more channels, that kind of thing. And now it's, they're using all kinds of digital technology. The computers have made life different in that it's possible to do a lot more in terms of regionalizing messages. You can record things off the satellite. You can run unattended for big chunks of the day. One of my jobs that I did at Wisconsin Public Radio was to record the breaks during Weekend Edition on Saturday morning. I did that on Thursdays. And so I'd say, you're listening to Weekend Edition. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock. Well, I'm doing it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday. And you're doing it, and then you can save money that way by not having to pay an announcer to sit there and do that. So there's those kind of efficiencies. There's the possibility for a show like this to have a guest come in on a digital telephone line, on an ISDN line, and it sounds like they're right in the room with you, and they might be in Philadelphia or Buenos Aires or wherever they might be, and they're right. They sound like they're right here instead of on a crackly phone line. So there's those kind of technology advances. But the big one for this network was the fact that you could have a network of stations. We had the two AM stations, Madison and Stevens Point. They were full power, but only during the daytime. They didn't reach the Fox Valley or Milwaukee or the far northwest or the far west. So they had the idea after World War II, FM. We'll build FM stations, and we'll just broadcast from one to the other and just repeat the signal all around the state. And that's how we'll get the signal out. We don't have to pay for expensive lines. We don't have to pay the phone company anything. It can just be, it'll broadcast from Madison. It'll be picked up in Delafield. They'll rebroadcast it on their frequency. It'll be picked up in Chilton. They'll rebroadcast it. It'll be picked up in Rib Mountain and all the way up to Brule. And that's how we got the signal around the state. And it was a very, very efficient way to get the signal, and it's very high quality. The signal at the other end, at the Brule end of the network, sounded just as good as when it left Madison. You couldn't tell the difference, and that was a real, real plus. Now, everyone could hear the network. Everyone in Wisconsin could have access to this service, where before they're trying to pick it up on AM, and it's a thunderstorm in between, you're not going to get
right,
it.
Right.
So it's
everyone
that was
hear
a
it.
big step.
That's great. Thanks, Nancy, very much for the call. Marty is next from Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I started listening to public radio in the mid-70s when I was living in Ohio and kept it up when I moved to Minnesota. And now I find, when I moved to Wisconsin in 1989, I feel like you started the Ideas Network just for me. So
yes, we did,
here.
Marty.
You all can really, thank me for that. And what I really want to thank you for is for keeping the public part of public radio. Our neighboring state has this huge conglomerate, it seems like, of corporate radio that's taking over the world, and I so appreciate that. Listeners keep you guys going for sure. Some businesses, but you really have kept those of us who think we're supporting public radio. We are really supporting it when we listen and support you guys. So I hope that made sense. Thank you.
It made a lot of sense, Marty. Thank you very much.
It's interesting. I started at WPR just weeks before the Ideas Network.
Did you?
Name started. When I started doing the news at WPR, you would say, this is the News and Information Service of Wisconsin Public Radio. And then there was the Music and Arts Service. Those were the two names then. But then the Ideas Network became the name of this service.
I want to talk about the news for a moment because this is very interesting. And it's also applicable to some of the talk that we do on the Ideas Network. You talk about the fall of 1947, Ray Vogelman, WHA's first news director. He had been a student announcer. And he submitted his memorandum on WHA news policy, his vision, which you say many of his policies remain in effect today.
Yep. Roy was had been chief announcer. He'd been a student. He'd been a chief announcer, and they wanted to do more in news. They had a wire service since the war years, and but they wanted to do more with news. And they told Roy he could either he'd been kind of news editor and chief announcer, and they said, "Well, you can pick one. You can either be chief announcer, or we'll make you news director." And so he became news director in 47, and he wrote this memorandum on WHA news policy, which is pretty much kind of the way that WPR approaches news today. It shies away from the sensational. It realizes it's speaking to a statewide audience. It tries to illuminate issues of public policy. It stays away from the fire, car wreck, crime stories that are the stock and trade of a purely local station. And there was a sense in his memorandum, he had this sense of speaking intelligently to the listener. And all that is still in force. And it's kind of become kind of the standard for public radio news. It's the last, you know, it's becoming the last home for radio journalism is public radio. A lot of commercial stations have decided to get out of the news business. Right. It's expensive to do news, to have a wire service and to pay reporters that can just focus on gathering news and developing a beat and developing sources. That's expensive, and thankfully at Wisconsin Public Radio we've had support through the years of developing first a news department in Madison, and then we started having one reporter not in Madison. Chuck Quernbach came to Milwaukee before there was even a bureau here to do reporting here. Always had someone at the state capitol for you know as long as I've been with the network, John Powell, and then Frederick Freiberg, and now Sean Johnson. To have someone on the ground at the state capitol going
very
to
important.
Hearings and getting to know the players and giving you the nuance that you're not going to get from another source. That's Roy Vogelman started all that, and he's he was all sides thought he was so fair, all sides of the political spectrum. They knew they'd get a fair shake from Roy, and his personal politics didn't enter in to his coverage. He was just so fair, and he did shows on public television as well. And he was news director till 77, so 30 years as news director of the network. So
important person. Thanks, Marty, very much for your call. Let's go to Laura from Madison. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hi.
I used to work at WHA in about 1973 or so. And I remember Roy, he would come in first thing in the morning and go through a stack of all the state newspapers, and he'd do kind of a digest of all of the state news. He did kind of a rip-and-read program where he just cut things out of the paper and stacked them up. And it was a very popular show because, you know, these were days before Internet and stuff.
What did you do at the station, Laura?
I was part of what was called then the recording service. So I did a lot of the production work. I recorded Ken Ost, Carol Collins, Cliff Roberts, Mike Hansen, Ronnie Hess, people like that.
Sure.
And one of the interesting stories was down the hall in the corner office was Don Vagley, who at the time was working on a theme for a new show, which became All Things Considered. And I remember him, you know, working out the various parts of that on a synthesizer.
Yep. Well, Don was music director for years, and WHA had a theater organ, actually, in the studio. And so we had a large theater organ, and he would play the organ at different times, and there were, you know, organ interludes. There was a show way back in the 30s called Cathedral Echoes, which was an afternoon drive time show of pipe organ music. But Don was music director, but he was an early user of synthesizers. And they developed the National Center for Audio Experimentation at Madison at WHA. And he wrote the theme for All Things Considered. The theme that they're using today was his. It's a version of the one that he wrote. He just passed away like last fall, I think. They did a tribute to him on All Things Considered. You can go to the NPR website and look at it, and they have different versions of the theme from the earliest days of its first incarnation.
I'll have to do that today.
Yeah, it's very nice. But Don was there for years, and he also instrumental in – he wrote a policy document on how to put together a classical music program and what kind of major versus minor, vocal versus chamber, all kinds of things, how you kind of weave a classical music show together.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's talk about hours for a moment. You mentioned that, 10:59 the weather would come on, and that different times of day people from different places would have chunks of air. What times of day were filled first? When did we become 24 hours a day? Did we do nightly programming, or was that problematic for a while?
We were on different times. In the early AM days, it was kind of like when you wanted to be on. Yeah, and there was nobody competing with the frequency back in the earliest days. You could be on, and there's a map in the book. We had a concert one night, and we had listeners in Saskatchewan. People could pick it up off the air because there was no other frequency, no other people competing for the frequency. When WHA got its call letters in 1922, I think there were 28 radio stations in the whole country. By the end of 1922, there were 600.
Oh, my gosh.
And so there was a lot of, a lot of competition for the airwaves. There were only two frequencies, too. 618 and 833 were the only two places on the dial you could pick up programming. And they started adding more frequencies, and then eventually what we have now for AM. But we were limited from the 30s until the 70s on the two AM stations to daytime. So as soon as the sun went down, you had to go off. And that could be as early as 4:15 in the afternoon in the wintertime. The FM could stay on all night. It was on till 10:30, 11 at night typically. When I started with the network, we were on till 1, then we pulled back to midnight as a budget maneuver. But with computers, you can stay on longer. There doesn't have to be a person there running the board. And so I think it was early 97, 98, something like that, we started going 24 hours with both services. The Ideas Network carries the BBC World Service overnight, and the Classical Service carries Peter Van de Graaff. And that's just automated. There doesn't have to be anyone there for that, so you don't incur any cost. So the station, it's better for the equipment. To turn a transmitter on and off is hard on it. To leave it on is better.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been 24 hours for the last 10, 12 years, but it was not possible in the early years at all.
Interesting. Okay, let's go next to Sarah on the road. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I just wanted to express my appreciation for the Wisconsin School of the Air. As a child growing up in central Wisconsin, we had four grades in our room. It was a poor school district, and those were the most enriching programs. Let's sing, let's write, let's draw. When you have a school with poor resources, it was a great enrichment to our educational program, and I just loved it and the people who did it.
Well, I was part of that, too. When I was in sixth grade, even though I was in a graded school that had a music teacher, we had Let's Sing. That was an added thing. And every Wednesday at 1:30, the principal would fire up his FM radio in the office and plug it into the sixth grade classrooms, and we'd sing along with the radio. Don Vagley was playing the organ on that show. And Norm Clayton and Lois Dick were the singers at that time, but had been Pop Gordon way back in the early days. And this was one of the things, developing the School of the Air. This is kind of tied into how the stations were funded. Back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, all of the money for the radio stations came from the university through state government. No underwriting, no pledge drives. It was all government funding. And doing the School of the Air provided a tangible benefit to the constituents of the legislators. You could go to legislators and say, look, your schools in your district are getting this great programming from the network that it really has value. It's really making your schools better. That's something that's worth supporting. There was a political component to it, not just pure altruism. And that's interesting because people think that it's always been like this. The pledge drive is a fairly recent phenomenon. Underwriting got going about the same time where there was corporate support. And so those things are rather later developments, but now essential because that support from all levels of government, federal and state, at best is flat or declining over time. So that's why the pledge drive is there and why listener support is so valuable.
Right.
And you have to budget for it, that kind of thing. So, but the School of the Air was one of those. In the book, I have 5 program chapters. There's one on School of the Air, which is the classroom programming for schools. There's University of the Air, College of the Air, which was adult education. There was the farm program. There was the homemaker show. And then there's Chapter Day. Those 5 have kind of defined the program schedule. And bits and pieces are still around. The School of the Air lasted till over the air till the 80s, and we were still doing it on tape for schools. I actually was on Book Trails in 1995, I think. I was the announcer for an episode of Book Trails once. University of the Air is still on. Norman Gilliland has that show on Sundays where he brings in educators. They talk about their area of interest, which is one of those driveway shows for me. I'll be stuck in my car. I can't get out because I want to hear the end of the
interview. Oh, Randall, you're devoted.
And then the Homemaker Show and the Farm Show have kind of – they merged later. And Larry Mueller's show is kind of the descendant of both of those. Larry's show when he started was the Farm Show still. And Larry's they've only had – 3 hosts since 1935. The one before him, Maury White, stepped down from the show to become a dean. I've met him. I met him a couple of years ago. The guy before him, Milton Bliss, was host from 1935 to 1950. I met him a couple of years ago, too. When I was working at WPR, he stopped by. At the time, it was 96. He was the oldest UW-Madison student. Still taking classes.
Oh,
and
you gotta love it.
Still has the great deep voice and all that. And but so they'd have since 1935. There's been 3 hosts of what's now Larry's show, and that so there's not a lot of turnover in this company.
I love the picture of Let's Sing in the book too, with everybody perfect, just looking at the book. They all have the books up and they're ready to.
We used to look at the speaker. We used to look at the speaker while we sang.
Oh,
and they also told there was a show we did. A story time for little folks, I think it was called. It was a reading program for youngest grades. They told you to put a candle on the radio at the front of the classroom so the students would have something to focus on while they're listening to the book.
Love it. Let's go next to Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Hello, good morning. And first I want to thank you personally very much, Randall, for putting all this interesting information between 2 covers. I know.
Well, thank you.
There's a lot of work, I'm sure. A lot of work.
I know it took a lot of your personal time to get it done. But the purpose of my call is I hope through your historical insight and the practical side of that is you might have some idea of what might be coming in the future. To capsulize what's been going on lately, for instance, English broadcast of what's audible on shortwave for the most part is already gone.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Comcast is trying to buy NBC because they know the likelihood of 4G technology is coming. I've told that the huge corporation Clear Channel has already sold out, and so. Approaching a day where it sounds like a person be able to reach in their pocket, push a couple of buttons anywhere in the world,
mm-hmm.
and have access to virtually anything. It seems like to me that broadcast communication for general consumption, those days might be numbered, and the real emphasis is going to all be on content.
Well, this is a topic kind of close to home because I have to keep my students current on this now. And we talk about this, first of all, you have internet streaming of radio stations, which is it's great for a radio station. Hey, we can be heard anywhere. I always ask the class then, I said, what's the downside of that? Well, everybody that can receive you anywhere in the world now has not 15 stations to choose from,
so
but 10,000 to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
And so content does become important. And a state, a local radio has had to change. Now with satellite radio, how can a local radio station compete? That's another question I ask my students, and they say, well, you do stuff that the satellite can't do, like local news and your local weather and things like that. And so, but there's going to be other, what they call distribution platforms. You'll be able to get what we now call terrestrial radio through some kind of streaming device, whether it's a computer or something else, through your iPhone. I'm looking at trying to get an iPhone app for the radio station at UW Oshkosh. We're working on that right now. So people can get us on their iPhone, just press a button and get us on the go anywhere. But people have written the obituary for radio many, many times, and there's still a magic there. There's still a value there. And stations have had to change, to be sure. This network is much different than it was 20 years ago than what it was 40 years ago. It had to change, but that core kind of ethic of serving the public and providing information of that makes you a better citizen, and also getting the riches of the University of Wisconsin to everybody, mm-hmm. that's all still here. Mm-hmm. And big chunks of what we've done over the years is still here. I was interviewed for a newspaper, and I said, I used to come on at noon every day and do the weather. And for me, that had special meaning because there's a direct line all the way back to the 1920s
yes.
of coming on at noon and giving the state weather forecast. And that, for me, had more meaning than maybe people that were filling in for me. But for me, that had a lot of value. And sure, to be sure, Larry Mueller points this out, that the show, that there's not that much of a need for his show to be an agriculture show anymore. He says farmers have other ways to get that. Same with the School of the Air. There are no more one-room schoolhouses that don't have access to a music teacher, an art teacher. Those have largely disappeared. So the stations had to change. And the funding forced changes as well. As government support dwindled and was reduced over the years, stations had to become inventive, coming up with other ways to raise money, pledge drives, corporate support, things like that. So I'm very hopeful about radio. There's always...
We're not going anywhere.
There's always going to be something there
right.
for people to listen to on the radio, over the air, for free.
Yeah. Randall Davidson, our guest. We have a few more minutes. His book is 9XM Talking WHA Radio and the Wisconsin Idea. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. And we go to Ron in Oshkosh. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. The last caller stole the first half of the reason of my call, so I'll just congratulate Randall Davidson as a fellow WRST alumnus
on
his efforts. So, I'll ask maybe the other half of the first caller's question. With what technology do you believe is actually going to settle as the world communication, audio communication? Is it going to be satellite, podcast, computers, some combination, or something new that we haven't yet even conceived of?
Oh, my. My guess is it's going to be probably a combination of all. The FCC came out last year and said that they're really leaning toward the internet as the future of transmission of information, more so than over the air. But then I look at how much it costs to buy radio and TV stations, and those prices are – there's still value. There's still demand for those, even in small towns. Even AM stations, even low power TV stations, there's demand for those. So I don't think it's going away that rapidly. But I'm proud to say I've been wrong a lot of times with predicting stuff. I was kind of late thinking that streaming on the internet would be anything, because the first time I listened to radio on the internet, I was like, wow, this is awful. This is nothing. This isn't going anywhere. But I was wrong about that too.
I guess you have to grow up in a certain time, and then you get into your radio pattern. So mm-hmm. my radio's got to be in a certain place in the kitchen, certain volume. Another one in a certain place. I'm not used to streaming it yet.
Radio's still that personal medium. It comes right into your
very
head.
Personal.
It's
mm-hmm.
absorbed right in the middle of your head,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that television doesn't do.
Right.
The internet doesn't do. You really experience radio very personally.
Yeah. All right. You have to come back. We have all these sound things, and we never got to them because we had so many calls. So please come back, and we'll just go through a lot of the sound, which would be great. And Randall's going to be in West Dallas at the Public Library next Monday at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
And then he will be in Green Bay Where is that?
The Brown County Public Library. That's October 7th at 7 p.m.
Okay.
Talking about this.
Great. And in the meantime, he's also director of radio services at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, which sounds like fun to me.
It is tremendous fun.
I would like to do that at some point. Thank you, Randall. You're just wonderful.
You're welcome.
Thanks for doing the book, too. It just is a complete history, and we're glad you did it. The book is 9XM Talking, WHA Radio, and the Wisconsin Idea, which is published by Wisconsin University Press, and Randall is the author. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 on the Ideas Network.